Well, welcome to this new series I want to do. It'll be a podcast and it'll be a video series where I interview rescue instructors and talk to them about just the kind of the modern state of whitewater rescue and their thinking about a lot of debatable topics. And I want to do this because I feel like there's a lot of debatable topics in what we teach, how we teach it, and just have good conversations. And we're going to start this week with Jim Coffey. It's a big get to get Jim on the show. I'm going to bring Jim on right now. And Jim, welcome to this conversation.
Thanks, Zach.
About whitewater rescue. And I can't think of anybody I'd more qualified to talk to right now, because not only do you have like a long history as an outfitter, you are a guide, an outfitter, you've taught rescue forever, and you've taught it in multiple locations. You've taught in the US, Canada, a ton in Central America, South America. You bring like varied experience in the real world. And so I'm stoked you're here and ready to like chit chat.
Sure. Well, look, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
So I'm just going to ask you 10 questions and we're going to go through them one at a time. And the goal is hopefully I came up with good questions and I can interview more instructors. And if anybody out there is an instructor and they want to do this same interview and ask the same questions, please contact me. I'll start reaching out to some of you that I know, but if you, I don't know, and you want to do an interview like this, just send me a note. We'll do it. I'm going to just shoot with 10 questions and we'll see how it goes. And the first one is about the terms whitewater rescue and swiftwater rescue. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and this interview is called Perspectives on Whitewater Rescue, because in my mind, whitewater rescue is what we do as boaters. Swiftwater rescue is what first responders do when they show up to some sort of rescue scene. Do you have thoughts about this? More of a question, less of a question, more of a like, I want to get your perspective.
Sure. Okay. So firstly, I just want to clarify, at the moment, I'm just speaking on behalf of myself. You know, I work with a bunch of different organizations and things like that. And some of the questions, some of the answers may not be from, representing those organizations, but as Jim Coffey, I'm super happy to go with some of these. And the first one, that's a good question, that difference between swiftwater rescue and whitewater rescue. And I'm sure that there are certain people that have more specific definitions of, this is swiftwater rescue based on the type of water, speed of the current, et cetera. I've heard those type of different types of explanations before, but I believe that certainly from a lay person's term, that trying to divide that professional rescue services towards the term swiftwater rescue and whitewater rescue towards the boating-based community is very reasonable. And one of the ways that I look at that is that when you look at Rescue 3, for example, one of the world's leading providers of rescue training, that's how they divide it. Their swiftwater rescue technician course is designed for rescue professionals, and their whitewater rescue technician courses are designed for whitewater professionals. So I think that I don't know if that's there may be a more specific definition that predates that sort of split, but I think that that's certainly a reasonable place to start.
Sweet. That's just what I want to know. Does that seem like a reasonable thing to think about? I know Sierra Rescue calls it river rescue certification. They aren't using the term swiftwater when they're teaching river guides and river people. And I think one of the struggles, maybe like Rescue 3 is where I first kind of got the idea, because they have broken it up that way. But maybe Rescue 3 gets a little sensitive if people use their proprietary information. And that's why Sierra Rescue calls it river rescue certification.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure of the background or the ins and outs of all of those things. You know, the American Canoe Association, who I do a lot of work with, refers to their programs as safety and rescue, as opposed to swiftwater or whitewater. But I think that, and I also know that there are people that will have a specific definition of what swiftwater is. You know, when the current moves at this speed or in this type of direction, that's considered swiftwater. But I think that's more of a definition between more like flat water and swiftwater. So there may be some people who have a a better answer to that than I do. So I'm curious to find that answer from other instructors as well.
Cool. Yeah. I'm going to keep asking the question. And also, if you leave comments in the comments section, we'd be happy to, if you want to ask him a question, now's the time too. And Rescue 4 is speaking in Spanish, which I think I know what that means with my limited Spanish. Somebody's saying hello to Master Instructor. Mejor.
Yeah,
instructor.
That's, I'm pretty sure I know who that is. So if that's Oliverio, buenas tardes.
Okay, let's move on to the next question. Sure. And I think when I talk about rescue with a lot of instructors, we start going down the weeds of like, this technique is something that's not really used, but there's like a once in a while you need it, so we should teach it. And I think there's a need for like a beginner rescue course and an advanced rescue course. I feel like a lot of people go straight to the advanced course and skip the basics. Like in the beginner course, we could cover like the core things of rescue, and the advanced course cover the fun, nerdy things in rescue. What do you think about that? And do you think those classes already exist?
So that's a good question. And the way that I look at things is that, and however you end up dividing this up, I like to think that if we were looking at 2-day blocks of rescue instruction, I would think that the first 2 days are about skills, fundamentals. And as a Canadian, I would say that if I was teaching my kid how to play hockey, those would be things like, you need to learn how to skate. You need to learn how to stick handle, right? Beyond that, you know, until those skills are somewhat are mastered, it makes it harder to move on to those more advanced skills. So let's call that the introductory version. The next section requires a level of, instead of teaching, a level of coaching. And so when people have those skills, how do we use those skills to their best potential? How do we have a critical eye to be able to make improvements on the way that someone throws, or the way that someone swims, or the way that they catch an eddy? So they already have those basics, but then they get some coaching on how to use those basics. And so that would be along the lines of, okay, now you know how to skate and you know how to stick handle, okay, now we're going to show how we break out of our end as a team, or how we do some of those things in a more refined way. And then the third level, I would say, is more of that expert level. And the way that experts end up getting better is that they're able to go and run with whatever their toolbox of skills are. And then from there, they get critical eye evaluation on how well they did those things. And so that's where I believe that lots of things that are scenario driven become valuable. And there's different ways that people might call this. You know, the professional rescue services might refer to this as operations, technician, and specialist. Some might call it, you know, beginner, intermediate, advanced. Others might refer to it as recreational, professional, and elite. But I think that there's different ways that we can teach based on different skill sets. And so sometimes we're teaching, sometimes we're coaching, and sometimes we're evaluating. One of the things which is difficult, to get back to your question, is when people want to either enter in on a level without having those basic skills, that can be problematic. And or trying to move through that series too quickly. And so, you know, you could have a 4-day block where someone is trying to learn the basics, and then you're going to try and coach them on those basics. But remember that those basics require a combination of training, practice, experience, and judgment. But what we give as instructors usually is training and a bit of practice, where people might need more practice. Before they really use them, they need to get a combination of experience and judgment. So there's a bit of a conundrum in people moving through the system too quickly. And it's a worse situation when people try to come in at a level without having the required prerequisite skills to be able to do that. Now, I say that, but many people can go from that beginner level, the entry level, to the end of that intermediate level over a 4-day period. When we start looking at moving into that further advanced level up to that sort of specialist level, it's hard to do that if you've only started learning those basic skills a couple of days beforehand.
Cool. That's a great answer. I'm starting with that question early because I feel like there's some things we're going to get into. We're going to be like, that belongs in the advanced class. It's a technique. Yeah, we should learn, but maybe after the fundamentals are covered in the beginning class.
And the way that I look at things, and you know, there may be some people who look at this differently, but one of the things that I think expert instructors do, or not expert instructors, good instructors do, is that they take complex situations and they're able to break it down into smaller, more digestible pieces that are easier for people to understand and easier for them to retain and remember. And so I like to think of Swiftwater Rescue as evolving around 7 core skills. And sometimes in that beginner level courses, and if that's the only thing that people want to do, oh, you know, I'm a recreational boater, I paddle in class 2, a little bit of class 3, I want to be able to look after myself and be able to look after my friends a bit, they may only need to focus on 5 of those 7 core skills. They might not need 2 of those at all. Of those 7 core skills, they might be broken down into 3 parts, you know, beginner, intermediate, and expert. And so when we're talking about swimming, we may give, you know, certain skills of swimming just for that entry level, and then we may up those skills for that intermediate level, and then we may refine those skills even further in the advanced level. But to me, we can break Swiftwater Rescue down into 7 core categories. And when you explain it that way, people realize, oh, you know, I don't have to remember how to do 40 different things because those 40 different things all subdivide into 7 core skills.
We could almost do a whole separate talk about the 7 core skills. Maybe they'll come up as we go, but I feel like that's actually fascinating to me. And I want to go down that path, but we're going to keep going down the questions.
Okay.
If you look at a typical rescue class that you teach, like let's say an average rescue class for river guides, what percentage of it do you think is prevention? And what percentage of it do you think is the cure? Like how much is preventing accidents and how much is doing rescues?
Okay. That's another good question. And I think that we're probably to a certain degree off balance. And the reason why I say that, and a friend of mine mentioned this to me recently, when I was saying, okay, we have to do this and we have to do this and we should teach this and we should teach that. And he reminded me in the association that I teach with that our courses are safety and rescue courses as opposed to just rescue courses. And I think that teaching just rescue is much easier. There's more concrete skills than teaching the judgment and decision making of safety. So I think that probably, you know, if we could be teaching more of the safety side, I think that we're weighted heavily on the rescue side as opposed to on the safety side. The more safety that we can interject, probably the better, because the best rescue certainly is the one that never needs to happen, right? But it's also something which is a little bit difficult to teach something which comes basically through experience and judgment. There, you know, there's a certain amount of time and opportunity for those things to happen, which doesn't necessarily happen or is difficult to be able to communicate on day one of a person who's taking one of these type of courses. It's easy to say, okay, one of the things we're going to do now is we're going to swim, and here's how we're going to swim, right? But to say, okay, here's how we're going to avoid our injuries. I mean, there's a few certain ones. I mean, one is that we know that the facts in whitewater of where there are fatalities are that if you're without wearing a PFD, you're more likely to drown. If you're intoxicated anyway, you're more likely to drown. And if you're a male between 16 and 26, you're more likely to drown, right? So those are 3 factors that we can refer to from a safety perspective. But I think it's more tangible teaching rescue. And that's where the majority of our effort goes into. I think that A lot of those other things in safety can come in follow up from courses that once people have, you know, taken the bait, you know, that they're really into this idea of rescue, that following through some mentorship with their instructors or through different, you know, there's a whole bunch of different whitewater safety or rescue groups where people can ask questions and can share their experiences, that many of those things may happen outside of the course hours.
I'm super torn on this, honestly, because I feel like my friends who are kayakers, if they're taking a what's called a swiftwater class, they say, how do we become safer? Take a swiftwater class. If they're taking a private boater one, they probably need the safety and rescue because they don't ever hear about the safety. If you're a commercial river guide, you're in a rescue class to learn how to do rescue. And you hopefully get the safety stuff from your guide training. So I feel like different audiences need different types of courses based on the other training that they get in addition to taking the class.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, everyone has to look at when they take a course, whatever that course happens to be, that's their launching pad. And when that course finishes, that's not when their training finishes. Really, when their course finishes, that's the launch of them beginning their career or whatever you call it, their time as, you know, as someone that's interested and involved in the combination of safety and rescue. And that's where I believe that, you know, if I'm from Eastern Canada, and in Eastern Canada, we get tons of people who take our classes because what they want to do is they want to live the Canadian dream, which is to go away as far as possible for as long as possible with as few people as possible with more food than rescue equipment. And they're worried about wrapping their canoe. And if we teach them how to unwrap their canoe, then they're going to leave really quite happy. But that's in fact, one of those skills like you described that doesn't happen that often, that probably they would get more out of a bunch of other type of skills, but that's something that they're very specifically worried about. And, and in fact, it could be very important for them because, you know, we could say, okay, that's great. You know, we taught you how to swim to shore and all those other things and look after the rest of the group. But now if you have no form of transport to continue to do downstream, or your food and your communication and all that other stuff is in that boat, then that becomes problematic. And when you mention the idea of, you know, certain skills that we rarely use but are somewhat important or are potentially really important, one of the things that I, if I relate that back to any other more public skill, is taking training in CPR, right? CPR isn't often used. CPR isn't often successful. But I believe that it's a skill that the general public, everyone, boaters, non-boaters, family members, whatever, that's a skill that everyone should just go through the effort to learn how to do, and not just say, well, you know, it's not very common. And even if it's not very common, it doesn't really work. So why bother, right? I think that for me, there are some things in our swiftwater rescue or safety and rescue or whitewater rescue, whatever you want to call it, that do relate to those. You know, if you divide these into categories, there's things that have a combination of frequency and severity. And so things that are very frequent with lots of severity, well, we better learn those things. And things that are less frequent but high severity, those are good to learn. Things that are more frequent and less severe, also probably good to learn. You know, so there's some different quadrants there of how to measure what's important for people to take away from their classes.
Okay, you already moved into question four, which is when should we be teaching CPR for drowning?
So I'm not sure whether the rest of the world is going to agree with me with this, but I just finished teaching with a group of 17 other instructors, 150 people in one sort of mass effort here in the small village that I live in Mexico. And the people who took that class were guides and kayakers and what they call protection civil, so professional rescue services within the local area, and people from the Red Cross, and moms and dads and people from our local community. I believe that we can divide that into sort of seven core steps. Some people make it five, but I think that if people are in the boating community, there's a few other ones that we add in there, that with those seven steps, I believe that those are critical skills because really, when you think about it, what's the worst thing that happens on your day? Your boat gets pinned? No. Someone's entrapped, but we figure out how to get them out? No. I'm pretty sure that the very worst thing that can happen is to have someone drown. So I think that that's an entry level skill. That's my opinion on that. And I know that that's not always taught. And when we think about it, it's like, hey, what's the worst thing that can go wrong today? Someone can drown. What's the best thing that can happen today? We can save someone or do some type of intervention to prevent someone from drowning. I mean, probably of anything that anyone learns on any of these courses, swiftwater rescue, whitewater rescue, safety and rescue, or just being a responsible member of the general public, that's probably a what I think is a critical skill.
So I think I agree with you. And Kelly just left a comment, CPR for drowning should be taught in every ACA course. I agree. I think
good job,
we're
Kelly.
Not getting CPR for drowning in some WIFRA classes are covering it, but not all. But like basic first aid is not covering it. If you take a CPR class, it's not really covering CPR for drowning. It's so fundamental to our sport, we should be teaching it a lot. And I've been trying to distill it into two facts that I've been sharing over and over and over. It takes like a minute. One is the first thing we have to do is give 5 rescue breaths.
Yep.
Like people just don't know that. Like if somebody like you, as quickly as you want to, give them 5 rescue breaths. And two, if they're drowning, you can expect foam to come out and you have to breathe through the foam, which requires a barrier. So as a whitewater paddler, you need to have a CPR barrier, hopefully under a small one under PFD, maybe a bigger one in the back of your kayak or wherever. But if we can just, everybody remember, like you've taken CPR, but it's different for drowning. 5 breaths as fast as you can, and then prepare to breathe through the foam that's going to come out. And just those two facts, I've been spreading it like wildfire as much as I can. Right.
So I'm going to put an extra little plug in here is that, you know, as I mentioned, 17 of the instructors from the ACA were just awarded Instructor of the Month from the ACA for doing this drowning prevention clinic. And we had 150 people. And one of our goals coming up this July 25th, which is International Drowning Prevention Day, is to get 100 instructors from 10 different countries to do a no charge or a free drowning prevention clinic for a minimum of 10 people each on International Drowning Prevention Day. And if we do that, we train 1,000 people. And, you know, there's one person in the world drowning every minute. And that excludes, you know, floods and typhoons and those type of emergencies. Dr. Chris Davis, who I know you've interviewed before and is a friend of both of ours, has really, along with Stephanie LaRue, led the way on some of these new topics in relation to drowning. And my job, or part of my job, has been spreading that information. And I think it's spreading wider and faster, let's say, than it ever has before, but still not fast enough, because I think those are critical skills.
And Kelly just wrote, the AC instructor should receive specific training for CPR for drowning. And that, I don't know if he or she, Kelly, has taken CPR classes that focus only on compression, only CPR. Yeah. So for drowning, you need to have breaths. I don't want to teach CPR personally. I've taken multiple woofers. I know first aid, but I don't really want to teach CPR because I'm not an expert. I'm very anxious about it. And I talked to somebody who owns a first aid company. I said, we need to be teaching this more. I don't want to teach it because I don't know enough about it. And she's like, you should teach it. And I'm like, well, how am I qualified to teach it? She's like, you know a lot about it. Just learn about it and teach it. It's better than like you just skipping it. I think a lot of instructors are skipping it because they don't feel qualified to teach it. And so
sure.
I think I'm trying to distill it in the simplest possible things possible. Right. Every time I teach CPR, I learn something from somebody that was there. Like somebody was a nurse or like did CPR. And I'm like, oh, that's an interesting fact. And so in my mind, we should be having more conversations about it so we all learn more about it.
Right. So I'm going to speak as a little bit of an outsider. You know, I'm Canadian and I'm currently in Mexico. And so there's, you know, here in Mexico, in our small riverside village, necessity is the mother of invention. So when we had 17 instructors, maybe four or five of us actually teach CPR, you know, including having Dr. Davis here, who's, you know, a world-renowned expert. But the rest of us just mimicked what those other instructors had. You know, we did an hour-long session beforehand, and then people were let loose to teach a two-hour session. And although it might not be perfect, and we can still suggest you should get certified in CPR through one of these other organizations, I think that from not coming from as litigious a place as the United States, so I don't know the answer for there, that I'm quite confident in having people teach that life-saving information without it necessarily being a certification. And there's a good example on that is that there's many things that are taught in a lifeguarding course, for example, you know, whether that's spinal management or rescue breaths or whatever, that they're not getting a certification, a formal certification in CPR, but they're learning all those things along the way. So I'm not afraid to, you know, I do teach CPR, but I'm not afraid to teach someone and have them spread that information. And maybe that will just inspire them to say, hey, I should go and do an urban CPR course because there may be some other things that I'm going to learn, like choking for conscious or unresponsive subjects. But that drowning protocol, like, it's really not that hard, right? We get them out of the water. We get them five breaths. We get them to a spot which is high and dry. We disrobe them so that if they're wearing helmets or life jackets, that stuff's not in the way. We start CPR as soon as possible. If a defibrillator arrives, we talk about that. If a, and then what the next steps are afterwards. And so we have that all mapped out, and we're trying to spread that through our organization. And the first thing is getting the word out. And we've just started getting the word out, as I mentioned, with 17 instructors being instructor of the month for that specific topic.
Yeah, I Chris made the point to me, like, this is our worst fear. Somebody, so we're afraid of people drowning. We should have a skill for handling that. We should be practicing that skill as a part of rescue. And ever since he said that, I'm like, yeah, that makes complete sense. I've been pretty fanatical about teaching it in every course that we can.
Right. Well, and once someone's a subject of drowning, you can't make them more dead. Right. They're already at that point. So I don't, you know, I don't see, you know, some of these other, you know, some places have liability related issues to that. I don't want to talk to that because I'm not an expert in that, especially because I'm not from a particular litigious area. But in that idea of, you know, am I happy that one of these instructors, Jose, taught the woman around the corner what to do if their kid is, you know, comes out of the water lifeless? Yeah, certainly am.
All right, we're going to keep moving. And we're going to start getting into the weeds now, some of the techniques and nerdy things, and get your opinion on things I think are pretty controversial, honestly, because I find myself debating or having conversations with people about these things all the time, whether it's on the phone, in a Zoom call, in person. It comes up all the time. Right. So we're going to hit some more like interesting ones.
So just a caveat to that for those who are listening. Zach and I, you know, go through a bunch of these different things on our own. I'm not familiar with the questions that he's putting today, but we do debate some of these things back and forth, and we're not always, you know, in agreement. But I do think that discourse and talking and trying to show someone's point of view and back and forth, when it's done, you know, with the same goal in mind, right, to make the community better, is really vital. So ready for these next ones.
And that's what I want to have more conversations like this with more instructors, so we can get everybody's thoughts and like all make our own opinion based off of other people's thinking. And really quick, Kelly asks, what type of CPR course do you recommend? I don't know. That's the problem, is there's not a CPR for drowning course. The Woofer research I'm doing in a couple of weeks with Desert Map Medicine, it's in there. But when I took my last Knowles Woofer research, it wasn't in there. It's barely anywhere, and that is a problem. And that's why I think it should be part of rescue courses, because we're not getting it anywhere else.
So to answer Kelly, July 25th, coming to a community near you, we're trying to make something like that happen, and we'll get the right people there.
Okay, the first one is just knots. Like, what? I think one thing that sucks up a lot of time in rescue classes is teaching knots. And I feel like some instructors, personally, I think they go way, they have way too many knots they're teaching. Is there like, in your mind, like a basic set of knots you feel like people should leave a rescue course with?
Sure. So the first thing is, I think that it's a time suck for everyone to be teaching knots during course hours. So what I do and what I highly recommend to people that, you know, I'm an instructor trainer, so I train quite a few instructors, is to send out a series of knots in advance to the course for people to learn how to tie, because now there's a whole bunch of different online sites that do sort of stop action so that people can learn how to do this. So that's the first one. To then secondly answer what you're looking at, there's sort of a general version. I'm going to say that intermediate level, you know, I described sort of three levels of introduction, intermediate, and advanced. I would say that in that intermediate level, the family of eight knots, of which I think that is six plus an alpine butterfly, or five plus an alpine butterfly, will do everything that anyone would ever need to do. Okay. I would then extrapolate that if you're in a introductory level course that doesn't have much in the way of rigging, they may need one or two knots, okay, being a figure of eight on a bite, and possibly some type of midline knot like an alpine butterfly. Okay. And if you're doing something more advanced, then you may add in a few other things, such as you know, different ways to tie prussics, that, you know, that maybe instead of just a standard prussic, one that's asymmetrical prussic so that it can be easily loosened. Add in a friction knot like a Munter hitch, you know. So I would take that middle core and say six knots. And if you're going lighter, maybe down to two. And if you're going heavier, add up to four more. But try not to teach during your water time. With that, you're just wasting everybody's time. So sending that out in advance, and you send it out in advance, and maybe you're going to get, let's say you have nine people in your course, you're going to get three who are going to master them, and three who are going to have the idea of it, and three who just didn't do any of the homework. Unfortunately, that sucks. But that's a reality. But then what you can do is you can divide people into groups and have people that have mastery of those in the groups with the people who don't, so that they're assisting to teach that. So it's not me trying to teach nine, where three are now bored because I've just done it automatically. We now have those three starting to teach some of the others. If you are teaching knots or doing a review of knots, I think that good instructors time things appropriately. And so what I would do is I would time anything that has to do with knots either at the end of the day, so they can take those things home with them and practice them to be ready for the next morning, or just before breaking for lunch, so then they can continue practicing over lunch to have mastery in the afternoon. If someone just starts off their day saying, okay, now I'm going to teach you a bunch of knots, I think you're sucking away people's water time. Yeah. That could be used much, much better. So I think there's a level of efficiency there. And again, like I was saying, knots would be part of what I believe is a core skill, which is rigging. And some people need zero rigging and other people are doing more advanced rigging. And so, you know, starting in the middle, we'd reduce some or we'd add some, but that middle is probably around six.
So I've heard the term family of eights before, but I don't remember what that means. What are those five, six knots in the family of eights?
So I would look at a figure of eight stopper knot, right? Because that's the basis of a bunch of other knots, okay? A figure of eight on a bite, right? So let's say you're going to clip the end of your rope to something, okay? Clip two ropes together. You might use a figure of eight on a bite. A figure of eight follow through, or what's called a Flemish bend. So let's say you were tying the end of two ropes together, okay? You could do that. A figure of eight follow through to make a bite. So you're doing an anchor around a tree, you know, wrap the rope around the tree and follow it through. So that's four. A double figure of eight on a bite, which has some some applications in anchoring, maybe in that entry level, not necessary, but in that intermediate level could be valuable. And then some form of midline knot, which could be a directional figure eight, which many people have a challenge with. So we switch that over to an an alpine butterfly, right? Cool. So that's, I believe, 5/8 and an alpine butterfly. And that's what I would hope that people would be able to have mastery of when leaving an intermediate level course.
If you're going to make one big loop of webbing for an anchor, which of those are you going to use?
I would then, I guess I left this out, I would then add in a water knot.
Cool.
Because I would then tie water knots to join those pieces of webbing together.
So if you're using rope, you're going to use the figure eight follow through. If you're using webbing, you're going to use the water knot. Okay, cool. All right, next question is, if you had to pick one mechanical advantage system, only one, I understand when we deal with pinned canoes, kayaks, rafts, there's a bazillion steps you take before you get to mechanical advantage. But when you get to mechanical advantage, if you had to pick only one technique that you could use the rest of your life, one, you don't get to pick two, you get to pick your one. What is that one?
It would be a simple 3-to-1 finishing with a change in direction.
Cool. Easy. The next one is going to be the big topic. We've already battled this one on the in the internet forever, and I'm going to bring it up. I'm going to try to be quiet. It's about strainer swims and rescue courses.
Sure.
And so basically, what's your opinion on them? What's the value? Why do you teach them?
Okay. So
there's a part two to this question, by the way. This is part one.
Sure.
Part two is easy.
So for those that are just listening in, this is one of those topics that when I saw someone brought up strainers and Zach had a response to it and someone else had a response to it, I then decided to take those three people and make a small group and say, let's debate strainers. And so we've had, so cheers to Nick White and Adam Lowry, if you're out there, that we've had lots of conversation back and forth on it. I believe in, call it a form of middle ground, and I'm going to describe the two extremes to start. Okay. One of those extremes is don't teach anything about strainers other than swim around them and swim away from them. And I think there's one school of thought with that. There is another school of thought says, yeah, but, and so anything that starts with yeah, but always is a little bit questionable. And so they go, yeah, but if they can't swim around, then they need to know something other than just smashing into it and getting sucked underneath it. Okay. And I can see the validity in both of those, in both of those arenas. The problem for the school of we should just be teaching people to swim around it is that we're now forcing that person to come to a decision point on when can I and should I be swimming around, especially if it's a tree which has fallen in the river. And if we're swimming out around the branch end, we're less likely typically to have a problem than if we're at the trunk end. That's not always the case. But when do they make the decision of, okay, I have to abort swimming around. I'm not going to get around this. And now I have to go up, this idea of quote, up and over. So what I'm doing in my classes and what I'm training rescue instructors to do, and I give credit to the swim around group, is that I set up a strainer and the very first thing I do is I get everyone to swim around it, right? Float downstream, okay, strainer, we point away, positively in the direction we want them to go. I get them to swim around the strainer, come back into shore. That's round one. I still go ahead and teach the idea of how to, you cannot swim around it. So now we want you to try and get up and over the strainer. I'll also give them the experience, which many people responded, let's say who are not instructors, about it was impactful for them to feel the force of the water, even in you know, gentle enough current, class 1-2 current, what it's like to be stuck there. So we'll give them an opportunity to do that. And basically I'll do a series of messing around on strainers, which is kind of similar to what's been taught for many years in that, you know, using that sort of what some people call it a gimmick of a, you know, a PVC pipe as a strainer bar, yeah, but give people the opportunity to mess around with that. But then I finish my class again with, okay, now what we're going to do is we're going to swim around the strainer. And so I've led with the action that we want is for people to recognize their strainer and swim around it. And I've closed with the action of there's a strainer, swim around it. When I do an assessment of someone's skills, the only thing that I'm assessing them to do is how to swim around it. And that's a combination of, you know, it's pretty easy to set that up. And that's the, you know, the core takeaway that we want people to have. But I do still do the sort of classic, okay, now we can't swim around this. We're too close. We're, you know, what are we going to do next? And that would be look at the idea of up and over, an opportunity to feel the force of the current, explain what happens if people go underneath using some different techniques that are taught in some different places of approaching it feet first. And I know a bunch of courses that specialize in kayaking that will then also have someone go up against that strainer sideways in their kayak and mm-hmm. see what they can do to be able to get themselves over top of it. So again, I think that there's a, you know, as the pendulum can swing to either side, strainer drill is a gimmick that we're actually teaching the wrong thing. We should be teaching people to swim around to, yeah, but what happens if they're too close and they can't swim around it? I've tried to make that pendulum land somewhere in the middle. So that's my thought on the strainer drill.
Cool. What do you, how do you feel about river guides in safety talks telling commercial passengers that if they can't swim around a strainer, they should swim over it?
No, I don't think that that's the place for it. I believe that the situation in for people who have the, you know, taking these as small bites, right? Like there's, as I mentioned, entry level, intermediate, and advanced. This is pre-entry level, right? A safety talk for someone who's going yeah. on a rafting trip. For those people, my personal belief, and again, I'm not speaking for any agency or whatever, is that what they need to know is swim around. The same way that I'm not going to teach them, you know, if we throw you a throw bag, we want you to grab it, you know, roll on your back and hold it in this hand so that this happens to your body. Instead, what I would tell them is that if they're holding it inappropriately, if you hear someone say switch, just move the rope to the other side of your head. So I'm not giving them any explanation on why yeah. to do that. I'm just giving them the what they need in that case. It will help them ferry over to shore better, right? If they grab onto it the correct way the first time, then I don't say anything, right? Good job. Okay, you're getting rescued. So that's my thought on it. That, you know, we start using smaller bites along the way. And you know, that even so in the preliminary level that we're talking about, that entry level, I don't even introduce strainers. It's not even part of my curriculum, right? It's part of that middle section where we then have that option of, okay, we can, you know, first go around, then we can mess around with it a little bit, and then we're going to go around it again. And that mess around has a couple of different reasons. One, because maybe they're going to find themselves in that situation. Maybe. The other one is experiential, about feeling the force of the current and then extrapolating that to, okay, now there's a strainer and a rapid that's class 3 or 3+. You just got worked in something that was in class 1+. I think that may help people in their decision-making and saying, okay, you know what? I'm going to portage this rapid.
Oh yeah, it's
because I'm familiar with how powerful it is to get stuck there. Whereas now I'm in class 3+ and I didn't do well in class 1+. Okay, I don't want to mess around with strainers. So I think there's a level of respect that people can learn in the way that I set up that drill.
Yeah, I think that I'm on the side of just teach swim around. because I think we've gone too far to the other side and I want it to be in the middle.
Sure.
And I think a lot about, I'm just like, I'm so tired of when I teach courses to people who've already taken a rescue class and I just put out there, what do you guys do if you see a strainer? A shocking number of people say swim towards and over it. It's shocking how many times I hear this in whether I'm teaching an IRF course or I'm teaching a class to like people that are rowing, like private boaters. And I'm trying to figure out where that comes from. And I think it comes some from rescue, but I think it comes maybe from social media too, because people are only seeing people in, because it's a great thing to share on social media. Like, look at a rescue course. We did all this cool stuff, including swimming over a strainer. So people learn rescue from watching social media, or they're at least like, then they'll learn rescue, but it's techniques are sort of drilled in by seeing that. So I'm concerned that too many people think the answer to strainers is swimming towards and over them. And so I'm somebody who's like, nope, let's just stop. Let's just be way over here and move the needle this direction.
So I think if I can add to that, and this might not, you know, sit well as, you know, in that thought, but I believe that sometimes it may also be in the way that question is asked, right? That there, you know, you can do an exam of some sort and you read the question, you give the answer, and then you go back afterwards and you go, oh, well, I thought they were asking something else. And so I think that there may be many people that we say, what do you do when you see a strainer? And in their mind is, what do I do when I see a strainer and I can't get around it? You know, do I stay floating with my feet up in front of me, or do I roll over and try to get over top of it aggressively? And so, you know, sometimes people misread that question, sometimes not, right? Sometimes they just, you know, and that probably comes from poor instruction, right? That someone said, oh, this is what you do all the time. I don't think that that's always the case. I think that it's sometimes the way that the question is presented and or quote written to them. And I think that ultimately most people or all instructors should get to the point of, you know, strainers can be, you know, it's a deadly issue or problem because it's also really hard to perform rescues in them, and it's hard to practice rescues in strainers. So that avoidance key from that safety versus safety and rescue side is paramount. But then, you know, we start looking at some of the other things. Okay, once people have that drilled into them that they swim around, is there anything else that they can learn from that strainer drill? And one of that is the, okay, now I'm stuck. Okay, this is really gentle, really easy, and this is the perfect strainer bar, right? How is that going to work if I'm up against a tree in whitewater, two grades higher than where I'm in now? Oh, I don't want that to happen. So I'm going to look at walking.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think this is a great example of where the conversation helps me change my like thinking and like helps me, like if we never had the conversation, I'd still be way over here and my needle's starting to move to like somewhere more intermediate. So like, but the more people I talk to about it, like my needle keeps moving. Cause it's like, it's one of those things I can't quite 100% wrap my brain around the answer. It's sort of like,
sure.
Like a political, I don't want to go into a specific one, but like a political issue where like, I see both sides. It's hard to pick one. I'm always trying, right. Not sure what I think. It's sort of like that. Like I can see both sides. So every conversation we have about it helps me be better informed and have thoughts about it. So,
hope this helps.
It does. It helps me for sure. And it helps me feel better because the more people that hear these conversations and also think about them, I feel like as an industry or whatever, as a community of instructors or whatever you want to call it, we'll keep moving the right direction as well. Like people will might get moved one way or the other, but at least it's informed and based on conversation. So I really like that conversation.
Good.
Okay. We're gonna move on. Question number 8. There's 3 more. These ones are easy-ish. So foot entrapment training for river guides, what do you think that looks like?
So when I say that I divide things into 7 core skills, which we're not getting fully into, one of those 7 core skills is strategy, right? And strategy can be put into a bunch of different categories. There's a little bit of common philosophy that we want to have. There's a combination of communication and organization that we want to have. And then there's things that are team oriented. And I think that that dealing with entrapment is one of those things that we need to work at as a team. And just like, you know, I mean, yesterday was Super Bowl Sunday, right? There are a series of different techniques in relation to entrapment that that would be really hard for someone just to think of and do on the spot. And so I believe in the idea that there are certain, quote, set plays in rescue, and those set plays are all determined on the condition of your subject. So if your subject, for example, in entrapment, I look at making three assessments very quickly in under 10 seconds for entrapment. The first assessment is, do they have an airway or don't they have an airway? Because if they do have an airway, if we can stabilize them, we can buy ourselves some time, right? If they don't have an airway, we know that someone can only hold their breath for between 30 and 90 seconds. And that after 5 minutes, we then, you know, without oxygen, that we end up having other types of damage as well. So those people, what they need is immediate extrication, not just lifting their head up and giving them an airway. They're not necessarily going to start to spontaneously breathe. So we need to get them to a spot where they can be worked on. To be able to do that in that short period of time, just making it up on the fly, I don't think works very well. So what I do when I'm teaching entrapment is that I'll teach some very specific set plays, like a stabilization line with an open cinch or something called a U-cinch or a step strap. And those are all for different profiles of subjects. So if we have someone with an airway, we can't get to them or we shouldn't make direct contact with them. That's always the best answer, is to make direct contact. But using a formula of analyzing our acceptable level of risk, if we can't get to them or we shouldn't go for them, then we're better to not put ourselves in that danger. So instead, we can then look at, okay, do we, what's our environment? Are our banks within a certain distance of each other, which I think is one throwback length, 20 meters or 60 feet. Then we have certain techniques where we can use two banks, other techniques where we can use one bank. If they're completely submerged underwater and we have access to two banks, then this technique, which I refer to as a step strap, can be valuable. And I look at all of those in practice and training as forms of strategy of working together, which all is an accumulation of a series of basic skills, because none of those things work if someone can't swim across the river or someone can't throw a throw bag accurately, right? Those are two of the things that we need to do. So I do, instead of simulations on this, I do drills on this where, okay, here's what we're gonna do if we find someone in this situation. Let's practice it once. Okay, that's good. Now let's do it and we're gonna time it, because I think that Swiftwater Rescue is a combination, like excellence in Swiftwater Rescue refers to three E's, which is expertise, experience, and efficiency. So we want to get them to try it, to get good at the skill, to be efficient in both people and equipment, and then also do it quickly because water is hard to breathe. So that's how I, where I put emphasis on entrapment training. And again, this is now getting into the weeds a little bit in some of that more advanced skills. So I don't look at entrapment in an entry level course, but I do look at it in a, or I look at it in a more basic fashion, like, can I, should I, yes, go and get them, right? In an entry level course, if I can't, or I shouldn't make direct contact with them, I'll look at some remote contact ways of doing that, which includes, you know, call it, quote, fancy rope systems. Mm-hmm. And then I'll also look at some more advanced ways of doing that in a elite level course or more advanced level course.
Cool. All right, moving on. Next question is, now that's a great answer. I have a hard time with that one, like what we should be teaching. And so I'm just trying to like get different people's opinions. That really helps me a lot.
Sure.
Favorite PFD. What PFD do you like? Do you ever, is there anything, do you like certain colors? What do you, how do you feel about flotation? What are your thoughts on PFDs?
Okay, good question. So I am, I'm a recently selected new member of the Astral Swiftwater Rescue team. So I'm going to talk first about Astral PFDs. Okay. And personally, the two that, you know, I believe in rescuers having a rescue harness. I know we've spoken a little bit about
next question.
Tether rescue. Okay.
We're going perfect. To question 10.
Okay. So I always paddle with a rescue harness. So in Astral, that means a green jacket or or an Indus. And so when I'm on the Ottawa, you know, I tried an Indus because it has more flotation to it. But to be honest, I'm a little more, and I've just ordered a new green jacket because the little less flotation gives me more mobility. And I'm a really mobile rescuer. I'm a swimmer, I'm a paddler. I can trade off flotation for comfort and mobility. So right now I'm gonna say an Astral green jacket. I also have used a series of NRS jackets. And I think that their paddling based jackets are getting better and better all the time. I have some concerns about their professional rescue jackets, ensuring that that their release happens smoothly enough. So that's something that everyone should test. If they're going to use a rescue harness, they have to test to make sure that they have a smooth release. And prior to this, I had a prototype jacket from a Spanish company called Ape, which I really liked. And it in fact had two different rescue harnesses in it so that I could have one set up just through the plastic buckle and one through a full weave. So I had different levels of friction and I could choose which one I wanted. And apart from all of those, for over 40 years, I've always worn a yellow PFD with black gear and a white helmet. And my whole company has done that. So it's kind of a branding look. And now Astral doesn't have yellow PFDs. So I'm, you know, looking at something different. I'm not recommending this per se, but as a rescue instructor, I sometimes try and get myself hidden in different places on my course while setting up different scenarios, which is a bit of a promotion or an excuse for black PFDs, you know, even though bright colors I think are typically better. However, you know, I've got a black dry suit, and if I put on a black PFD, then I'm very ninja-like and it's certainly very slimming. But typically if I had my choice, it would be yellow, a brighter color. So Astral, NRS, Ape, and I haven't really tried the rest to be able to make much comment on them.
The flotation thing is interesting to me because I hear what you're saying. Like, I feel more agile, more like a ninja if I'm in a lower float PFD, but floating is really nice. Like if I'm going for a long swim, floating is a good thing too. Almost everybody's chosen what you're saying because it's just more comfortable. But should we be thinking about having more flotation just for safety?
Right. Well, I think that, you know, in responding to that, I think that Astral has done a good job with producing the Indus. You know, the idea of the Indus is to be a higher flotation green jacket, particularly for people who are paddling the Indus, you know, who are paddling in big volume. You know, I come from a big volume river from the Ottawa, but I also come from a drop pool river. So I know that, you know, even if I'm end up spending have a little bit more downtime, I'm going to come out into flat water at the bottom. So I think that that's been addressed to a certain degree, but I do know that a full, let's say rafting customer PFD with 28 pounds of flotation or whatever that equivalent is in metric, whatever. That to me is too bulky and I lose too much maneuverability. And I find that is the case for me when I look at jackets designed for professional rescue services, you know, let's say 4.6 or Northwater or Mustang or some of the NRS jackets. It's for me, that's too much. And I also, you know, when I travel, I don't travel with four, three or four different life jackets to be able to pick and choose along the way. One of the things that I do is a lot of canoeing or kayaking. And when I, need to be canoeing or kayaking, it can, some of those can be too big and too bulky. Sure. So, in that category, I would say that, an Indus for bigger water and flooding, does the job, and a green jacket probably still does that same job. Maybe if you're willing to trade off a little bit of flotation or trade off flotation, there's not a lot of difference in the maneuverability between those two jackets, right? Whereas between a green jacket and a big 4.6 jacket, there's a lot of difference in both flotation and maneuverability.
Yeah. All right, last question. And this, we already told you what it's going to be. This is another topic where my needle is always kind of moving. Like I see the pros and cons of the rescue harnesses on PFDs. And I don't have, like, I have opinions, but every time I have a conversation, it moves a little bit. And so I want to get your thoughts on, like, why we train with these rescue harnesses. Because I know you do like them.
Sure. Yeah. And I do. And I think as you may be, your needle may be to one side, mine may be to the other, and maybe the spot is somewhere in the middle. But this gives a great opportunity for explain something that I've recently come up with a little bit of a conundrum of using some terms that some people that I thought were just like normal terms that everyone used that some people were less familiar with. So I'm going to describe a couple of different situations. Firstly, with rescue harnesses in both a basic and what I'm going to also refer to now in that advanced elite version, my organization company Esprit happens to be one of the places that uses those skills a lot, and probably a lot more than other outfitters. So let's say much more so than your outfit, for example. Some of the places that we use them is that we have a rapid, which on the Ottawa, which is referred to as kind of a quote easy class five. That part of what makes it class five is a very sticky hole at the bottom called purgatory. And if our rafts drop in to that hole, they will get stuck there. And if someone falls out when that raft gets stuck, that's very problematic because they're going to be held underneath the raft, recirculating in a hole. And so in that case, we have to first get the raft out, and then we have to get that person out. And we know that water is hard to breathe. So our timing for that is, we have to be fairly, we have to be quite skilled at that. And so when we do that, we do use tethered rescue to be able to make that happen. And we use, a more advanced form of tethered rescue where we have our, our tethered rescuer, but we also have an extension so that we can clip onto the boat. And when we start pulling, we're not pulling against the grip of our rescuer's hands, which is the weak point in that system. We're not pulling against the harness, which is the second, or shoulders or harness, which are the next weak points, that we can make that direct line. So that's one place that we use them. And then I also run a canoeing kayaking company here in Mexico, and we do a lot of paddling on rivers with waterfalls. And at the bottom of those waterfalls, there's often quite sticky holes. And there we do just a very short tether that if someone's about to get stuck and pulled back into one of those, that we can grab onto them, tug them out, and then push them off down the rest of the rapid or the next drop or whatever that happens to be. So I've been fortunate enough to use those skills a lot. When we start looking at, the more general, should we set up a throw bag or should we, set tethered rescue, for safety? The way that I look at these two things, and these are terms that some people use and others don't, is that I think that we can divide all of our rescues into two different types. One of those is conditional rescue. And conditional rescue refers to the fact that the subject needs to somehow be a participant in their own rescue. So when I shout to someone, hey, feet up, swim this way, for them to rescue themselves, they have to be an active participant. Or if I throw them a throw bag, right, that they have to be able to grab onto it. So that's another form of conditional rescue. Or even if I pull over to them with my kayak and ask them to hold on, that's another form of conditional rescue. The other form of rescue is what many people refer to as true rescue, or in Spanish, rescate real, right? Real rescue, true rescue, or go rescue. And with that, and I know I just saw a comment that you made the other day, is that when we have someone who can't help in their own rescue, we have to be able to rescue them. And so true rescue refers to when 100% of the success of the rescue is in the hands of the rescuers. And you had mentioned that, okay, well, if someone, let's say we had a problematic drop and we didn't know what was going to happen, but they were expecting some carnage and people were going to come out of there and we don't know what condition they're going to be in, right? We have to plan for the worst, but hope for the best. And so maybe we could go downstream and put a throw bag. And if we had another rescuer, we could put another throw bag and another throw bag. But if it turns out that a conditional rescue won't work, we could have 100 throw bags and none of those are going to work. So we have to have a contingent to be able to perform some form of true rescue. So let's say our subject comes out and they are unresponsive, cold, injured, frightened, or we're just talking about an inanimate object like a piece of gear, that we need a form of true rescue. And you mentioned that what you would do is you would row your boat out to them, pull them in, and row back to shore. So that's great. That's a form of true rescue, right? That's a contingency plan for someone who doesn't meet the conditions of conditional rescue. Another way, form of true rescue, is that you could enter into the water, swim out to them, grab onto them, and swim back into shore. That's another form of true rescue. I've, you know, one example that I have of that, we have a place where people cliff jump, and a woman cliff jumped and she had a previous shoulder injury and her shoulder popped out when she hit the water. Well, she could now no longer swim into shore and she couldn't catch a throw bag. And so in that case, I thought, okay, true rescue, I'm standing on shore, I'm gonna have to swim out to her, grab onto her. And then I had downstream safety who could throw to me and I then make the conditional rescue, but she couldn't be part of the conditional rescue because she was injured. So the last one is
when they throw to you, holding with your arm, or are you talking about clipping into your harness? Why?
So there, I'm just referring to a strong swimmer rescue is also a form of true rescue. Okay. But we know that instead of me just swimming out and grabbing onto her, easier, faster, more efficient, more secure way that I can be brought into shore while holding onto this person is if I'm tethered. And so that's where the idea of tethered rescue, in lieu of going out with a boat, maybe you don't have a boat available, right? Or maybe you don't have personnel to get a boat out to someone and pull them back in and look after them and get back into shore. And instead of just swimming out to them, which is also another form of true rescue, which is a viable form of rescue, but has some additional risk because now you're just another free swimmer in the water, that here, we could use tethered rescue where we have the benefit of being a throw bag with hands. So we basically make throw bag rescue, which is normally conditional, into a form of true rescue because we have a rescuer on the line who can grab onto the subject. So that's how I look at where we would use tethered rescue. We also know that, you know, sometimes it's not just the person that we're trying to get. We're also trying to get their boat or other gear, which we can't use any form of conditional rescue for an inanimate object. So those are some certain applications where we may end up using our rescue vests. In the kayaking world, we also use our rescue vests to maneuver equipment around. In certain more advanced applications, if we had an unresponsive subject, maybe we would clip onto that person to be able to paddle into shore, right? Other situations, we might be clipping onto their boat to be able to paddle into shore. And so we can't really, there are some other techniques that we can sort of bypass a rescue harness, but by using a piece of webbing and draping it over your shoulder, which they often do in Europe. But I think that that having a rescue harness and using it in its proper applications, and these are more advanced applications. So I don't even touch rescue harnesses in my entry-level courses. That's something for the intermediate and advanced. Certainly has its use and advantage. And I believe that the more people, combination, the more they know about it, the more practice they have with it, the more they see that as a viable tool in their toolkit. Because if they're good at it, that also reduces the risk of using it, because it certainly a higher risk form of rescue than, you know, being tethered than Or it's a certain, certainly a higher risk form of rescue, period. So what's your thought?
Yeah. I mean, I feel like a lot of the true rescues you described are sort of on the, what I would call the swift water side of things. And when we're whitewater boating, we tend to have boats. We don't always. And so most of those true rescues are done, not all of them, most of them done with boats. The example, the last time we employed a rescue harness on a trip was only like a year ago. There's a big rapid on the Illinois River. We run two gearboats and then two paddle boats. So I have two people at the bottom of the rapid river for safety. I'm the lead boat. Usually there's nobody in my boat. But this day, based on a variety of reasons, I have somebody in my boat who probably can't swim if we flip. And so we have two people downstream. My choice is two people with throw bags or one person attached on a rescue harness, ready to go with somebody on belay.
Right.
I chose the person on a rescue harness, ready to swim out and get that one person who couldn't swim. If I had gotten hurt in the flip and the other person couldn't swim, there's nobody really to help me. So it's a tough call, you know, like, which one do I do? You know, but we sure went with the one because the person in my boat was not going to be able to, he was definitely not going to be able to self-rescue. So we went with the least risky of the options, which was, we'll use it in that case, but it's pretty rare that usually there's a boat at the bottom. It's pretty rare to have that. Like, I think in whitewater boating, that case where you have two people with the training they need ready to do that action in the right place. That was just a unique example.
Sure. So here's what I think of going back to the idea of when we run the rapid, we don't know what's going to happen, right? We're looking at some different probabilities. And normally our probabilities are, if someone falls out, we'll throw them the throw bag, they'll grab onto it and we'll swing them in the shore, right? However, and that works with conditional rescue, and you could have one or two or three throw bags there, and the first one misses, you have a second one or a third or whatever. But if it turns out that the subject doesn't make those conditions, okay, and that could be that they don't know how to swim and that they're going to panic, or they're really cold, or they're injured, or they're unresponsive, it doesn't matter if you have one, two, three, or 100 throw bags. That's not going to work. So so the idea of, although it's less likely that we're going to have some form of true rescue, it is, in fact, quite essential to at least have some idea of that. So maybe what would happen, and this has happened to me, like I said, with that idea of someone who jumps off the cliff and then they dislocate their shoulder, mm-hmm. right? I didn't have time to just throw another throw bag, and I didn't have time to clip on. So I just went. My preference in that situation is I would have rather gone connected so that I grabbed onto them, I can just look after them. So, you know, very rarely, when we look at it, tethered rescue works for anyone, right? It works for someone who is responsive, okay, uh-huh. that could meet those conditions, but it also works for the variety of scenarios where they don't meet those conditions. And whereas a conditional rescue, like a throw bag, only works for certain people who can participate in their rescue. And so when I think about, let's say I'm going to send three people on downstream safety, mm-hmm. do I put the tethered rescue team first, like upstream, followed by a throw bag, or do I put the throw bag followed by the tethered rescue team? And if you were to look at the idea of using low to high risk options first, this idea of talk, reach, throw, row, go, toe, or refrog, people would say, you put the throw bag first and the tethered rescue team second. But a different way of looking at that, when you think of acceptable level of risk, is that if you can use and you should use tethered rescue, there's something to be said of putting that first, because it is in fact the more reliable form of rescue.
We just know it's going to work.
And what we want to do is just get the rescue over with so we can have lunch and keep on going downstream. Yeah. And so a good way to think about this is nobody ever really says, here's what we're going to do, Zach. Let's start with plan B, the throw bag. And if that doesn't work, we'll try plan A, which is the true rescue. Instead, people always say, let's do plan A, and we'll follow that up with plan B. There's a few other reasons why to do it in that order as well. But really, what when I have this debate back and forth, and I'm not trying to say that there's a right answer or a wrong answer, but when we have the debate back and forth, one of the things that I do tell people is that to make everybody happy, we'll put a throw bag and a tethered rescue team and then another throw bag. And then
this is a lot of assets.
Yeah, then that appeals to everyone. But it is a lot of assets. So, but if I did have, you know, if I was in a situation and I didn't know what was going to happen, I couldn't anticipate how everyone was going to come out of this. If I had my choice between true rescue followed by conditional rescue, mm-hmm. or conditional rescue followed by true rescue, I would always put the true rescue first because that's the one that's most likely to work. That's our plan A. And that's you rowing out to someone in a boat and rowing back to shore. That's a form of true rescue, mm-hmm. right? That's, you've got a whole bunch of throw baggers and they realize that the person is unresponsive. Well, someone might just have to go and get them just swimming,
yeah.
right? But if you're anticipating that in advance, you could do that with tethered rescue, right? And here's another one. Here's another one to solve your solution. You set up your tethered rescue, but the actual rescuer is holding a throw bag. So that guy comes out of the boat, but he seems to be waving and his hands are in the air and they seem to be working. Mm-hmm. And that rescuer can then just throw a throw bag and they're successful with it and they tether them into shore and nobody launches. But they come out of the boat and the guy seems to not be responsive or seems to be hurt or injured or whatever that happens to be, that rescuer puts their throw bag off to the side, goes in and gets them.
That was basically what we chose in that instance. My point is, and I've used tethered rescue a handful of times in my career. I'm not saying it's a not valuable technique at all. I'm just questioning where do we put it? If we have two rescue classes, introductory and advanced, my take is we don't talk about introductory and we cover an advanced. If we have three courses, introductory, intermediate, advanced, we don't cover an introductory. We talk about the release of the harness and intermediate, and advanced is when we really go. Like, I think people need to practice releasing right. with it, because I don't think enough people understand that. And then go into an advanced. That's my take. I just feel like it's being taught too early in people's careers for how little it's used in the real world, and more time could be spent throw bags, swimming, flipping rafts. Like we're skipping the basics to do the stuff we use once every 5 years as guides, well, every 10 years.
So the way that I would look at that is that introductory level, we wouldn't do any form of tethered rescue. That intermediate level, we would. And it would be that basic sort of on the fly, here's a form of true rescue. This is called tethered rescue. Someone's floating downstream, they're not responding. We go in and get them, we pendulum mm-hmm. into shore. And all the mechanics of the idea of how to enter and when to enter and how to thread your harness properly and distance between rescuer and anchor point or belay point and how that belay is going to manage. Those are all the basics of that, you know, something's floating downstream, go get it type of drill. And then we look at more advanced applications of that where we use tethered rescue in the idea of getting someone or something out of a hole, like I described earlier, mm-hmm. or, you know, someone has swam out of their boat and they've climbed up onto a rock and they can't swim back to shore and they can't hold on to a rope back to shore. I've swam out to them and I've stabilized them. We're going to try and figure out how to get them back to shore. We don't have a boat handy with us. The boats are all further downstream. Someone throw me a rope. And instead of me just holding on, I clip in my harness. Yep. I grab the subject and I pendulum them into shore. And I'll practice that as a form of pickoff. You know, there's someone right at the edge of the water. Let's time the idea of swimming out to them, getting them, grabbing onto them and swinging back into shore. Mm-hmm. So I think that probably, just like anything, this is an advanced form. It's a more advanced form of rescue. The more people are practiced at it, the more skilled they are at it, the more likely they're going to pull that out of their toolbox. If you had a fancy tool in your toolbox that you don't really remember how to use and you don't use it very often, you'll probably go, no, I'm not going to use that. Just give me the hammer, right, instead.
On that same topic, if you give this to people too early, they might use it when they don't need it. They might be like, you know, it's like, I think people are way more likely to throw throw bags when they just learn how to use a throw bag. You know, maybe they need to hold back on the throw bags. I feel like we're giving them a tool and now they're going to try to use it when they shouldn't. I heard an example of somebody using it one time on the Rogue River to get to a raft that was stuck on a rock. I'm like, why don't you guys just paddle a ducky down there and get it? And I mean, why would you tie yourself to a rope and swim out to that boat when you literally have a ducky right there? And so I feel like if people learn these things too early, they try to use them when they don't necessarily need them. I'm gonna stop this conversation.
Sure.
Going for nope. I do love it.
And we have, nope. No
I do want to. I do to just to back up your point on this. When that sure. situation happened with me on the Illinois, and I the moment I realized I had to go lead boat with a person on a boat that can't swim, the fact that I could look at those two guides who I knew were trained in this and say, "Go do that thing," and then have to ask me how to do it, where to do it. I knew they were trained on it. I go, "You guys know what I want? Go set that up." Was amazing. We didn't have time to have a whole class sure. about how to do it. And so I recognized that being trained on that was helpful. I'm just questioning it a little bit to figure out what that line is to how much and when we do that training.
Right. I think there's, you know, one of the things that always comes back to rescue instruction is the idea of that KISS principle of keep it simple and safe. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when people are, you know, and I understand you're saying that people might want to jump to the shiny thing, you know, the coolest, mm-hmm. newest thing that they just learned. And again, that's not, you know, they have to learn it at some point in time to be able to use it. But I think that, again, another part from this idea of safety and rescue is to try to get people using the simplest techniques first, not always, quote, the safest technique first. We've always mm-hmm. said, you know, use the safest technique first, but we also know that some of those more advanced techniques are in fact more effective. So use a technique that you can use, so you have the ability and you should use because it matches, it's within your risk tolerance. And if that's the case, use whatever technique is going to work best, because what we really want to do is be successful with our rescue, get it over with, have lunch, and have fun going out boating again.
I love that. Okay. We've gone well over an hour. I think well over an hour. So I told you, let's try to keep this to an hour. Sure. There's one question to answer from the audience. If the audience has more questions, throw them in the comments. Otherwise, we'll probably shut this thing down pretty soon. Can you see that, Jim? What's your take on the clean principle, keeping equipment inside and not dangling from your PFD to prevent from snagging like cowtails, hardware, sure. et cetera?
Yeah. So I agree of having a very clean profile. So I don't have extra things dangling off of me that don't need to be there. So I have to look at what equipment I want to have. Going to use it, and where's the best place to store it? So I do paddle with a rescue extension or a cowtail or pigtail or whatever you want to call it. I try to reduce its snagability by ensuring that it's releasable on both ends, so it doesn't go onto a fixed point on my PFD. It goes onto a blowaway point, both on the front and on the back. With extra things like whistles with long lanyards or multiple carabiners hanging off the sides of my jacket, I want to keep as clean a profile as possible, so I don't allow any of those extra things. I do wear my knife externally. And I know some people say, oh, it's not as clean as if you had your knife in your pocket. But I also want to have my knife not just to be easily accessible to me, but if I happen to be stuck somewhere and someone can't get at their knife or they don't have their knife, that they can see where mine is and they can end up using it. And mm-hmm. so, you know, I measure a combination of those things, that it's not just, you know, it has to be this way or it has to be that way. I make good decisions on a risk benefit analysis of I'm going to risk wearing a rescue extension because I use that in a lot of ways. You know, I lead whitewater canoe trips with class 2-3 paddlers who are swimming all the time. So I do a lot of towing, but I then also make sure that that's as low a profile as possible, releasable on both ends, tucked away. I, in fact, with my with that rescue extension, instead of having it my belt woven through a D-ring and then around to the front, I add in an extra carabiner there. So if for whatever reason, whatever I'm doing, that I want to have that shed off of my jacket, or I want to attach it onto someone else, I can just do that by taking off the carabiner as opposed to opening and unthreading my belt. And I spend enough time threading and rethreading that I find that a bit of a pain in the butt. So instead, small locking carabiner, holding that on my jacket ends up making it easier to take off, put back on, put on to someone else if necessary. So good question. Thank you.
There's one more question here. Which knife do you use?
So that's a good question. And I think one of the problems with knives is always based on, on the sheath with them. So I use a Cricut Bear Claw because I think that's the fastest way to cut through something that I'm stuck on. It doesn't make a super clean cut because it's really serrated. But if I were stuck in a piece of webbing or something like that, it's my one stroke go through. I also do, in fact, carry a Spyderco folding knife inside the pocket of my life jacket, which is a little sharper and will make a cleaner cut. And I can use that for a variety of different purposes. Your knife needs to be sharp. So we used to say, don't use your knife for anything except for cutting rope. And I think that a little bit differently. I think that people should use their knife for whatever they need to use it for. Use it all the time. Just make sure that you maintain its edge and that you keep it sharp. The more someone uses it, the more they realize where it is to then be able to get at it and access it quickly. So so I find that that the Bear Claws are the best way to just one slice through a piece of rope or webbing. In my dry bag, I've got shears. You know, there's other ways to be able to cut, but I have that externally on my PFD so that I can use it, or someone who, if I were the person who was entrapped in something and I can't have access to it, that someone else could access it from me.
I want to go back to one thing and then I think we're done. And it's asking this question, what's your take on the clean principle? And it's really interesting to me because I feel like this idea of the clean principle is sort of like the clean line principle, which is a very European thing. So like the clean line principle is you don't want to have knots at the end of your ropes, so they don't get pulled through your system and caught. So like, it's crazy, not crazy. It's crazy might be the right word, might be the wrong word. It's interesting how fanatical Europeans are about not having a knot at the end of the rope. And it seems sure. Like smart, but they call that the clean line principle. The clean line principle is that. Where did this term, the clean principle, come from? Do you have any idea, Jim?
I think that it's just an extrapolation on that. The clean line is no knots at the end of the line. And there is some certain situations where I do in fact go against that, mm-hmm. especially when we're looking at that idea when we're talking about tethered rescue, that short throw tethered rescue. So if I was doing something long, I would put the bag clipped onto me so that the rest of the rope is really clean. Yeah. But if I'm just doing a quick enter 1 or 2 meters away to someone at the base of a waterfall, I really don't want them to have to take all that rope out and have all the rope on shore, yeah. which hard for them to manage. So I'll let them keep that rope in the bag where it's easier to manage, mm-hmm. despite the fact that yeah. may, in fact, not be, quote, perfectly clean. The clean principle on someone's jacket, I think, comes from, again, a reaction to where, you know, it used to be years ago, and I'm, you know, part of this school, you know, having been at this for a while. You used to be able to look at people's experience based on how many carabiners they had clipped to their shoulder strap, right? And then you would see, the contrast to that with, you know, someone has 6 carabiners on their PFD that yeah. you watch them swim and they're kind of sinking because they're getting weighed down so much. So the idea is that that with that people can, you know, and again, there many people still use non-locking carabiners. I'm a big proponent for locking carabiners on the river, because we don't want something like that just getting snagged on us. And so I think that's where it comes from, that the cleaner your profile, the less danglies that you have, the less likelihood that you're going to get stuck somewhere. And one of the ones that was always I found funny was that people would sometimes have their whistle, you know, with a ring onto the hole in the zipper of their PFD. And so just when they would get in the water, the resistance of the whistle in the water would then start to pull that zipper down. And so by putting that zipper or that whistle in a pocket, that avoids that from happening. And the same thing, dangly carabiners off of me. I might, if I'm doing some type of fancy rigging, I might park a carabiner on my shoulder or in my pocket, but it doesn't live there. And so I put that stuff in my pockets or I carry that in a dry bag.
That was almost a question of the 10. I had knocked it out. Was it, do you wear a carabiners in your PFD? Because it's shocking how many people do. Okay, one more question for the audience. Oh, sure. Go ahead. How?
No, go ahead.
What's the ideal length for a cow's tail?
Okay, great. So, I would say an ideal length for the cow's tail that I use is a bungee type tail. So it, you know, it extends and contracts. So when it's extended, I would like to be able to hold that in my hand and be able to swim with it. And again, this is a more advanced thing because we use this in advanced tethered rescue, of using that to clip onto something, let's say, which is stuck in a hole, and that I may end up swimming with it to be able to get to that craft. That, that's a different story. That's more advanced. So from the tail of my jacket out to the length of my arm is probably a little over a meter and a little less than half a meter, or sorry, a little less than a meter and a half. And I have that on a bungee, so it's constricted. One of the things that I'm working on that I'm not sure of, and I bring this up a little controversially, is that many people have their rescue extension, pigtail, whatever, that some people will have that and put that in their side pocket with the zipper closed. That's a big thing with the Astral jackets. And and Astral has not had any reported problems in that system. So there's something to be said that if it's not broken, don't fix it. But there is a concern potentially that if that starts to run out, let's say getting snagged on something, then it gets chalked inside the pocket of the jacket. So a potential improvement would be to put Velcro on instead of a zipper on one side of those jackets, so that that carabiner, if it was in there, would pull out, opening up the Velcro. I think that ensuring that if we're wearing this, that it's releasable from the back, that it should also be easily releasable from the front. So I have mine carabinered to a quick release point on my jacket rather than a fixed point on my jacket. So to answer the question, between a meter and a meter and a half, I would say, let's say, you know, I'm generalizing, a meter and a half with full extension and a meter compressed with bungee, which is often inside the webbing. Not big and dangly. And if it were big and dangly, because some are longer than others, I would take a bite of that and just slip it inside the side of my PFD. So I don't have a big loop hanging off of me, that I'm going from the front of the jacket, just tucked into my the side of my PFD, and then around to the D-ring on the back.
Have you seen the Kokatat one?
I'm not 100% sure.
It's really cool. It's like very, it's the one I use. It's right along the side. And then once you clip it to something and there's force, it some Velcro snaps and it goes from being just this long to like 6 feet, like 2 meters long, 6 feet.
Yeah. So I have seen those. One of the things that I'm a little, so I haven't worked with those, so I can't critique them per se, but I do like the idea of it not necessarily extending out to that full length, which could in fact provide, you know, if I've clipped onto a boat and then I've you know, which is stuck, and then I start moving downstream, mm-hmm. I'm a little cautious about things coming tight really fast, right? If it's closer to me, there's less of that potential shock. Whereas the longer it is, if I end up moving downstream and then it engages, then that's more likely, if I'm in a canoe or kayak, likely to capsize me or have some other type of issue based on that force coming, that load coming on really fast.
In our classes, we use a rescue dummy swimmer that just goes and people have to save it. And sometimes they don't save it. And so it's just getting ahead of our group. And I have to chase, I'm the one that has to chase it down and get it. And I use the Kokutat one all the time it's basically an unconscious swimmer. It's just like a, sure. not a person. And I use it all the time for pulling that person ashore. It was great. I like the length. Because if it's on my stern, it's a little more annoying to deal with like a big, heavy person thing.
Sure.
If it's behind my boat, it's really nice to pull. So for dealing with the unconscious swimmer, I think it's great.
Yeah. And that the astral ones are longer as well.
I don't know if Astral even makes those. They just
the one that sits in their pocket. It's about two meters long.
About the same length as the Kokutat one when it goes long. But does Astral actually make that one, or is it like a third party thing that people add?
No, Astral sells it.
Oh, they do. And it's meant to go in that pocket.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't realize they meant it to go in that pocket. The other thing I've seen somebody do, you're talking about, so like when it's in the pocket, if you go, what you're saying is if you release this end, the carabiner of the pocket chocks in that zipper. I've seen that happen. Also, if it doesn't chock in the zipper, if it's an unlocking carabiner, it can clip on the pocket and attach. Like I've seen. If it's not locking, a lot of people have.
Yeah, I think that people should, you know, the only reason in my belief why those tethers end up having non-locking carabiners on them is that in the manufacture of these things, non-locking carabiners are cheaper than locking carabiners. And I promote people to take their non-lockers and switch them out for a locking carabiner. The reason why is that, you know, the idea of your carabiner getting stuck on something or you know, if it's non-locking and accidentally clipping onto something, the likelihood of that happen, many people might say, is like 1 in a million. But I also believe that 1 in a million things, in fact, on the river happen all the time. So, you know, the idea of saying, well, it's not that common, or what's the likelihood of that happening? These weird things do happen, and we hear lots of anecdotal stories about them. And I just think that there's no reason why not to have a locking carabiner. And if you're concerned about, you know, quickness of being able to clip onto it or whatever, a two-stage twist lock just means that it's locked when you want it to be locked, and it's easy to open when you want.
I think a lot of kayakers are using non-locking carabiners because it's the only carabiner that will fit over a paddle. So right. Like if you're you can put over a paddle, then you can like paddle the paddle away if you need to.
And my answer to that is without it taking much longer or any of those type of things, is that clip over the paddle and back onto the tether.
Oh yeah.
Right. And then you have it captured anyways.
I don't agree. I agree with you 100%. We shouldn't have the non-locking carabiners out there. Not even I feel stronger about it. Like, just don't do it. You seem very nice about it. Like, I don't think you should. I'm like, no, just don't do it. But I can see some kayakers like, well, I want to have this because it's my like hook over a paddle, but your point is great that you just like sit like, and that's a great idea. Cinch it around.
And I'll get people to practice that. Okay. Do it like this. And now do it like this. And the timing or whatever, it's like, oh, but I was like 3 points of a second faster by just clipping it. I'm like, oh, whatever. Right. That timing doesn't make it.
Usually you just paddle and you throw it to shore and you keep going.
Of course,
you don't
I'm nicer about it. I'm Canadian. Really nice.
You are the uberness about it. Well, we're gonna wrap this up, Jim. Thanks for taking the time. The conversation is so interesting to me personally. So, like, I personally appreciate your time that you spent with me to like answer these questions. I'm pretty sure everybody else feels the same. You know, thank you for, you know, I know you're doing a lot of these Zooms and podcasts, and like your time sharing your knowledge is so valuable to all of us. So thank you a lot for doing this. And stay on though, because we want to chit chat with you when we close this thing down.
Well, and again, thanks so much for the invite, and I really appreciate, Zach, that you know when things come up. I mean, we were just talking about this between the two of us the other day, and the next thing you know, it's like, okay, we're gonna do a gear garage. How about Monday? And it's like, Sure. Monday sounds great. And this is the way, we don't have to all agree, right? There's lots of different ways to perform rescues. We want to try and not be dogmatic about how we do things. But if we can learn from each other, if we can debate things back and forth, if we can move that needle, you know, that someone's on one side and move them more towards the center, or the other side more towards the center, or whatever that happens to be, we'll all end up being better off in the end. And I think that's where, you know, a combination of not necessarily agreeing on everything, but the idea of having good, civil, educated discourse makes us all better rescuers. And I think that that's, you know, something that you do very well. So I appreciate having me on the show.
Oh, I do my best. I'm very opinionated. So I get fired up for sure. But I think we all do. But right. Thanks for being here. I'm going to shut this down and I'll chat for a second afterwards.
Right on. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for tuning in.